I'm Rachel Bovard.
I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Emily Jashinsky.
And I'm Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. So, hi, everyone. We have a bunch of things to discuss today. We're going to kick it off with Josh, who's going to talk about how our Western media has been completely in the tank for Hamas in the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. I'm going to talk a little bit about the baby bust, whether it's cultural or material. Emily is going to talk about beauty through architecture, and Ben is going to wrap us up with a robust discussion of our media's groupthink when it comes to the Wuhan lab leak. So with that, I'll kick it over to Josh.
Okay, thanks, Rachel. Yeah, so really kind of a well-rounded panoply of topics for you, the lucky listener and viewer today. So we'll kick it off with just the complete intellectual dishonesty of the Western media, especially as it pertains to covering the latest conflict in Israel and Gaza. Anyone who's remotely followed these topics for years, perhaps decades, this is old hat, perhaps. This is not exactly a new phenomenon that the Western media, and by extension, the Democratic Party, the Britain's Labour Party, kind of all the major kind of Western left of center parties are kind of all in the tank for Palestinian terrorist groups. They have been for many years. It just seems from my perspective why this most recent conflict, which lasted for about 11 or 12 days, they reached a ceasefire last week. I'm not entirely sure that's the right decision, but a ceasefire has been reached regardless. It just seems like the media kind of, from my perspective, really sank to epically new lows. And I take a modicum of personal pride, obviously, you know, in editing the Newsweek opinion page, we were putting out a lot of kind of counter programming, so to speak, trying to put something out there to combat the predominant narrative. But, you know, my take on this, the column that I wrote a couple weeks ago, which, you know, is similar to a piece, a very powerful piece that Lyle Leibovitz wrote at Tablet Magazine, and a couple other people kind of made this point. What the American and the Western left is doing in general, and we really just cannot divorce kind of this concept of the Western left from the Western media. The two are just intertwined. They are almost synonymous with one another. What they are doing is they are projecting the 1619 Project, intersectionality, critical race theory, multiculturalism. They are projecting this entire paradigm of largely domestic relations and domestic interactions and way to think about domestic issues. And they are exporting it onto a Middle East conflict that they know nothing about at all, that they are totally ignorant of the history of, and for which it is, for any number of reasons, a poor fit. So according to this ridiculous narrative, obviously, Israel, which you know, the listeners and viewers will obviously know, is a very important American ally. They obviously share the same enemies that we do, whether it's the Islamic Republic of Iran, perhaps predominantly, the Muslim Brotherhood, a number of fanatical Sunni jihadist groups. But according to this kind of woke narrative, Israel becomes Derek Chauvin. They become kind of the white oppressor, right? Notwithstanding the obvious reality that, in fact, anyone who's visited Israel can tell you that it is probably a lot less, quote unquote, white than you think it is. In fact, the plurality of Jews living in Israel are not Ashkenazi Jews of European descent. They're actually Mizrahi Jews of Middle Eastern descent, who most lay people in the West probably can't even tell the difference from Mizrahi Jew and an Arab. In any event, in this narrative that's totally oversimplified and dumbed down, Israel becomes Derek Chauvin. Hamas, which is a literal genocidal Islamist death cult, its 1988 founding charter calls not just for the annihilation of the state of Israel, but for the murder of every Jew the world over. Hamas, nonetheless, becomes the oppressed George Floyd. And we've seen this over and over and over again. And I, you know, one particular instant, example that kind of brings this whole kind of just moral depravity to light was obviously Israel's bombing of what I believe was a Hamas intelligence officer kind of headquarters of sorts, where I guess the Associated Press and Al Jazeera happened to have offices. Remarkably, the Associated Press claims not to have known that they were sharing an office building with Hamas. No one should believe this for a second. Let's not mince words here. They are lying through their teeth. There is no way in which you can have a quote unquote bureau in a terrorist run organization. And Mati Friedman, the former Associated Press reporter from the region, has talked at length about how reporters there, like Hamas militiamen, would literally come into these journo's office with like guns and like say, like, you will cover this conflict the way we want to or else ... And yet the Associated Press has the gall to lie to us through their teeth and say they did not know they were sharing an office building with an internationally recognized terrorist group. So There's a lot to say on this, obviously, not just the media itself, but the statements that we saw out of kind of the far left of the Democratic Party in particular, the Rashida Tlaibs, the AOCs of the world. Up is down, down is up. Plenty of people can have their own opinions as to the IDF's particular military tactics, okay? Anyone can have their opinions as to how any foreign military engages in a particular conflict. My own personal opinion on this is I think the IDF goes probably further out of its way than most, if not any military in the world, to warn civilian casualties to get out of the way, especially when a terrorist group is literally hiding behind them as human shields. But reasonable people can disagree as to certain tactics here. What I don't think reasonable people can disagree on is that this conflict is not this ridiculous 1619 Project woke white versus brown narrative that the Western media and the Democratic Party seem so intent in covering it as. So just kind of want to accentuate that, just underscore that. It is really getting worse. I genuinely do worry, especially as we're seeing Jews just beat up in the streets over this. That's the death of the anti-Zionism is not an anti-Semitism narrative before our eyes. I really do kind of worry about the toxic future of the way the media increasingly handles this. It's just really awful. So I'll cut myself off there. I could rant about this for hours, but I'm curious if anyone has thoughts on what we've seen out of our media colleagues, I guess we would say.
Well, I can just quickly pick up on a thread that you started there, Josh, where you said you think it's getting worse. And I think one of the reasons it does seem to be getting worse is the efficacy of distilling the narrative into Chauvin on Floyd's neck. When you're able to sort of inject that, or you're able to sort of use that framework, graft that framework onto this conflict, which is incredibly complicated and has so many different, has such context that people, can't just jump in and start suddenly saying it's Chauvin versus Floyd, because it's really not. It's not that at all, but it's when you're able to sort of simplify that and make it accessible to people in this larger social justice momentum that is right here in America now, then things are, of course, going to get worse. The sort of anti-Israel sentiments are going to get worse. The Democratic Party is way too tolerant of it, has been way too tolerant of it. You can think back to what happened with the Women's March. You can think back to what they how they have coddled Louis Farrakhan. You could keep doing this. But the reason it's getting worse, it's because the Democratic Party is simplifying things and grafting anti-Israel sentiments onto popular movements here.
I think that's right. And I think it goes again to this normalizing of this narrative in so many different contexts. The Democrat Party has figured out that it's a very useful narrative and they want to apply it to situations in which it doesn't apply. And I think it's been fascinating to watch the congressional response to this, because if you even go back a year ago to the actual sort of George Floyd, Derek Chauvin situation, everyone was compelled, right, socially and with media pressure and, cultural pressure to speak out against this and to, bend the knee to this narrative that America was a racist country. And if you did not do that, you were publicly excoriated. And yet, you literally have, I think to Josh's point, there's been so many disturbing videos of, Jewish people just being out on the street. There was a video, I don't know if it was from Germany, where this Jewish man, Orthodox, is standing there on the street and somebody just walks by and kicks him, because he's just standing there. And the fact that, the Democratic Party cannot call that out, or if they do, it's always hedged. It's like anti-Semitism has no place, but, right? There's always a second clause that qualifies, what's going on as somehow somewhat justified. And I think that that really goes to the shallowness and superficialness of these race arguments, is that they're pick and choose. And I think when you cast everything through the lens of race, you have to live and die by that. And that's, I think, what you're seeing right now, the sort of superficial nature of this, of that race narrative coming out in this Hamas-Israel conflict.
I'll make a couple points. And I published a book last year on this, my first book, American Ingrid, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party, which I wrote to capture the how and why the left and the Islamists have allied essentially against Judeo-Christian Western civilization, and their hatred of the little Satan of Israel is analogous to their anti-American sentiments as well, and their deep historical, ideological, political roots of this. And also there's a reason that the Democratic Party has largely caved to its anti-Israel and also anti-American wing, anti-Israel, of course, being against America's national interest in the final analysis, not just on the basis of shared values and history and policies and principles, but of course, on our very narrow national interest of national security and stability in that region. Setting all that aside, one point worth making is that in terms of the anti-Semitic attacks, which I believe Democrat rhetoric and policy have created a safe space for and normalized in this country and legitimized to some extent. Look at hate crime statistics in terms of religion historically. Go back every single year in the FBI numbers, and Jews dominate in terms of being the victims, usually over 50% every year in spite of that small population. Yet Jews are considered the oppressors par excellence, white supremacists, right-wing extremists, et cetera, with Israel being the living, breathing personification of it in the paradigm that the left has created. But really, what is this about at the end of the day? It's about masking hatred of the collective Jew in Israel under the guise of this progressivism, you know, the sort of Derek Chauvining of Jews, as Josh spoke to there. But it's really just a clever dodge, essentially, of the fact that their real antipathy is towards Judeo-Christian Western civilization, of which Israel represents the first line of defense. So this is shameful. It's ultimately going to undermine America. Jews are the canary in the coal mine for Western civilization, and that they're under attack right now, and that one party clearly is fine legitimizing figures who side effectively with our worst adversaries and the worst adversaries of our closest ally in that region, I think speaks volumes about a deep sickness that we're going to experience in this country. So this is a telling moment, and it portends very bad things for America's national interest.
Well, it's well said by everyone, but speaking of portending bad things, Rachel, why don't you tell us about our American fertility crisis?
That was a smooth transition to, yes, the fertility crisis. Now, I think we touched on this briefly a couple of months ago as proposals began to proliferate in Congress around this idea, you know, that there is a natalism crisis in America, right? Our fertility rate is dropping such that we cannot replace our population anymore. We've never really seen this in America thus far. And you know, there's bills in Congress to essentially address this financially, right? They're recognizing a hardship that families face in having kids, in supporting kids, you know, making the assumption that the reason people aren't having children is exclusively a material one, or at least recognizing that through policy, this is one way in which you can address the material concern. Now, I have always had a little bit of concern with this narrative because I think it's incomplete. Not that it's false. I do think there are material challenges facing families throughout the country, but I think there's an additional element to it. And Rebecca Heinrichs, I think, just completely summarized it very well in a recent piece in American Mind, in which she touched on the fact that so much of the fertility crisis and family delaying family formation and all these things that conservatives care about is actually a reflection of our complete stagnant culture. And what I mean by that is we now have a culture that doesn't prioritize family formation. Actually, it shuns it if it's done too early. And by this, I mean, if you are a woman in America today, right? And I mean, millennial, Gen Z and on down, you are told from a very young age that, you know, your highest and best purpose is to pursue a career, to do it early, to go to college, to go to graduate school, to delay the family until you've, you know, hit the metric of these like very specific career goals. And women who deviate from that path are pretty much socially shunned to some extent. You know, if you think about the high schooler that's like, you know what, maybe I'll go to college or maybe I won't, but I'm going to get married at 24 and have three kids immediately. That's not applauded, right? That's like, what's wrong with you? What ill choice have you made? You are not fulfilling your potential. And really, this is the roots of the 1970s coming home to roost at the end of the day, right? This is sort of the empowerment language, the sexual revolution language, the, you know, putting women in the workplace, which is not bad necessarily, but telling them, changing the narrative to be that is the highest and best used for women. And I think the result has been, there is no discussion of this anymore, right? We've normalized, you know, delaying marriage, delaying families. And I think Rebecca captures it very well. And I think I can speak to this even from my own experience where she's counseling grad students, you know, to start having a family right away and then sort of build your career around it. And the anecdote she gives is her student was like, well, no one ever told me that. Right. And it's, you have to pause and realize, no, this is actually the case for a lot of women. And so I think when we think about the family formation crisis, which I do think it is a crisis, we really have to grapple with the fact that the material aspect of it is one, and I think a somewhat smaller stake in this conversation than the cultural crisis itself. And how or if public policy can even address that, I think is an open question. And I think this is a real challenge for conservatives because we have very much ceded the cultural ground in many institutions, in the way in which we talk about families and all of these things. So I think it's our own failing in particular that it's gotten to this point. But I'm curious kind of to, I'll put it to the group, you know, as we think about family policy going forward, is there a role to address the cultural phenomenon? And if there is not, are these material proposals just sort of flying in the face of something that, you know, they can't even change really at the end of the day?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can hop in first. I mean, it seems to me like that there's a role for both culture and the state to play here. I don't necessarily view them as mutually exclusive. I would agree that first and foremost, it is a cultural problem. A lot of these problems that we're seeing, as Rachel quite accurately says, and the Rebecca Heinrichs essay in American Mind was fabulous and would highly encourage listeners and viewers to check it out. A lot of this is downstream of, you know, of post-sexual revolution, this notion of, you know, the single, the dual income in the household. And this all kind of gets into the Biden plan for state daycare. All these issues just end up relating to one another. It's kind of this new paradigm that the way to find fulfillment is through the workplace, not through the family, not through your church or synagogue, not through the more traditional and frankly better ways to achieve meaning and fulfillment in your life. So a lot of this obviously is, as Rebecca quite aptly says in American Mind piece, we need to just kind of get to the point where we are comfortable telling the younger generation that you don't necessarily, even if you're really smart, by the way, it doesn't matter. Let's say you have like a 145, 150 IQ, you're like a genius level Mensa member. Like a lot of people who are like trafficked in these like elite circles, they were kind of in accelerated programs in elementary school through high school. They get into an Ivy League college, go to top PhD program, law school, whatever. They kind of assume that the quote unquote natural or quote unquote best thing for them to do, even with like those, even with like that background credential, you know, is they're destined to find fulfillment in the workplace through their vocational career and whatnot. That may or may not be true for some people. It is certainly not true as like a baseline rule. So we do need to just get more comfortable with basically telling younger people that it is totally okay to focus and prioritize on having children. The economic part of this, kind of the public policy part, you know, I mean, American Compass did these two surveys back in February, I think it was. It was over 50%, of American families said they did not have the amount of children that they wanted to. And either a plurality or a majority of them basically said that financial reasons were a factor. So I do think there probably is a role for public policy here. I know some people in their minds kind of get like a little icky, like a little, they find it like just unpleasant to think about the state trying to incentivize people to make such a deeply personal decision to make babies. But the reality is, if you care about the nation, if you care about culture, you have to kind of care about this kind of Burkean kind of, you know, one generation to the other chain. You have to care about progeny. You have to care about children. You know, I'm flying to Europe this week, among other friends of me in there. I'm meeting my friend Gladden Papin, University of Dallas professor. Gladden texted me from the Budapest, Hungary airport a few days ago. And like, there's like a sign on the wall when you land there. It's like, welcome to family friendly Hungary. And Hungary has like gone like above and beyond as far as like this paradigm is concerned. It's kind of like the archetype for a lot of like religious and social conservatives. I'm not necessarily saying America should go there overnight, but there are, I think, healthier models to really kind of invest quite literally in the future of the country.
I interned for Christina Hoff Sommers for a couple of years at the American Enterprise Institute when I was in college, and I'm a longtime fan of her work. And I remember she was working on a new edition of The War Against Boys, which is a book she released in the 90s, back in, it must have been like 2013 when I was working for her. And I was reading the book and thinking, oh my gosh, this is oppression. I mean, one thing that we can't leave out of this conversation about women delaying children to the point where they're missing their target number of children. If you look at how many children women say they want and how many they actually end up wanting, and a lot of that has to do with marrying later. And not one of the reasons that women marry later, of course, it's not just that they get the cultural signaling that they need to focus on work. It's also because there are fewer marriageable men because we have a culture that has targeted masculinity and that has left boys behind literally for decades since Christina wrote the first edition of that book in the late 90s. And here we are in 2021, and we're yielding sort of the bitter fruits of these cultural signaling. And a lot of times we think of this just as sort of like abstract think tank conversation. no, like this actually has really real consequences and American women are dealing with it right now. There's a ton going on here, but I also think it's important to talk about in this context, how the dearth of marriageable men is also something that you can trace exactly back to the leftism in our culture.
Yeah, so let me just on the public policy side of things, look, I think there's merit to being naturally uneasy about how the state gets involved with our families. But on the other hand, when the state is actively working to, in effect or in actuality, undermine family formation and the development of two-parent families raising their children, then obviously, at a very minimum, a first principle of government should be do no harm. Do not seek to destroy the fundamental foundational building block of a healthy and vibrant society. So that'd be one point on public policy. I do think there are other aspects of public policy that are potentially dealing with symptoms rather than getting to root causes as well. We can set that aside for a moment, but it should also deeply disturb us that the end result of not only policies that dissuade people from having two-parent families and really forming truly strong family units is then the outsourcing of raising our children to public institutions, which of course are woke and essentially help create the next generation of social justice warriors, as opposed to healthy and patriotic citizens. So there's that aspect of it as well. And last but not least, I'd say it's incumbent upon us to engage here in culture. And look, there's nothing wrong with advocating that people pursue whatever path they believe will lead them to be fulfilled and pursue their happiness and whatever they think their purpose is on this earth. But that said, we should also advocate clearly that it's incredibly fulfilling. It helps us mature. It helps us become true citizens and actual adults to actually form a family. There's no good time economically or in any number of other material measures to have a child necessarily. But on the other hand, the benefits of having a children, forming a family, and the responsibilities that are engendered as a consequence of it just lead to so many manifold benefits for the individual, for the family, for their community as well. And it's incumbent upon all of us to make that case vigorously.
So with that, I think we'll take it over to another Western tradition under attack, which is, I think, architecture and the theme of beauty.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the wonderful Yoram Hazony sent a tweet that really resonated with me, and I'm sure with a lot of us, where he responded to some juxtaposition of a building in Hungary that had been before and then was sort of remade in the classical architecture tradition. And Yoram said, conservatism in action, something to that effect. And I think it's such an interesting concept to consider that a lot of times now when we describe something as conservative, it's as simple and basic as objective beauty, that there's now something conservative, and this has been in the works for a really long time, but there's now something politicized and conservative about the concept of objective beauty because the left is attacking human nature and attacking our sort of foundational truths and using this sort of concept of moral relativism to chip away at human nature and our concepts of human nature in a way that is now politicized the buildings. It's not that conservatives have politicized the sort of question of architecture, but here in this country, we have a great hook to have this conversation right now because we're taping this the day after Joe Biden purged proponents of cultural architecture classical architecture from a cultural government agency. And this became a really hot topic in the Trump administration, of course, because the Trump administration took measures to insist that federal buildings be constructed in the tradition of classical architecture. If you live here in DC, if you've ever spent a day here in DC, you know that we have some truly hideous federal behemoth buildings. The Labor Department, for instance, you could just go down Constitution Avenue and look at some of these monstrosities. But I think, again, when you see Joe Biden really leaving no stone unturned, and even, you know, purging out those proponents. It's not as though Joe Biden made this decision himself and was kicking back and, you know, going through his list and saying, we must get rid of the classical architecture proponents, but they're going to be gone. So it's a stark reminder, I think, of how here in America and in Europe, there is a new movement really to recognize things as simple and basic to humanity as objective beauty in these movements to resurrect classical architecture, which I think are important. It's not something I ever thought much about in the past, and certainly not when I was sort of coming of political age during the Tea Party years. But let me kick it open to the group. What did you think of the stark juxtaposition in Yoram's tweet and Yoram's sentiment combined with what we now know is happening in the Biden administration when it comes to simply proponents of classical architecture who are well qualified for the positions that they held?
I always kind of think what's interesting about this debate, because, you know, when Donald Trump sort of started this, right, and it was like the Make the Buildings Beautiful Again initiative, and he was sort of mocked and ridiculed by everybody who was like, what is this? It's like coming out of left field. I do not understand. And for people like me that really grew up in the philosophical, traditional conservative mold, this is inherently conservative. Roger Scruton writes about this beautifully, this notion that, you know, one thing conservatives hold dear as a cultural and societal value is that we can view beauty, we can seek beauty in our environment, in our architecture, in the things we do. And this goes hand in hand with sort of the transcendent moral order, the things we seek out in our day-to-day life. And this again goes to this idea of conservatism as a tradition being a worldview and a way of living, as opposed to, I think, more of the progressive leftist ideology, you know, which really is politicizing every single thing. And so to me, this is just a natural expression of what traditionalism actually is. And it's fascinating for me to watch how many people aren't aware of it. And I really do think conservatives need to do a little better job in explaining, like, this is what a healthy culture is. It's when you seek beauty and pursue beauty and you have it all around you as a normative ideal and speaking again to the transcendent moral order that guides us all. That's an inherently conservative thing.
And that you can define beauty, and right. There aren't a million definitions because everything is relative.
Good day for our Hungarian friends. We're getting a lot of love on this podcast episode, I guess.
Babies and buildings.
Yeah, babies and buildings. Yeah, exactly. That should be our new tagline, right? You know, this is also another recurring theme, and this one that Emily emphasized here, and you know, it's like the third straight podcast. I guess I'm going to talk about this. Is like, yeah, like objective beauty, like, is a thing. Objectivity in general is a thing. And we really have lost our ability to appreciate that. This kind of gets, it's very closely thematically related, obviously, to the war on merit, to the war on kind of upward mobility. The left increasingly stands against all this stuff. I went to college at Duke in North Carolina, and the original kind of Duke campus is like soaring kind of a neo-Gothic architecture. It's like pretty purposely modeled after mostly Princeton, but like a little bit of Yale, I think, was what they intended it to be. But then there's this weird like grafting on to the original Duke campus from like the 1970s, and it's like hideously ugly. It's like postmodernism some sort of other architectural term that's escaped me from like the 1970s. Brutalism, I think that's a term. Yeah, it's like brutalist architecture, and it's just absolutely hideous. And like it's literally impossible to walk from like that main like just really beautiful quad to kind of these like kind of like more off the beaten path dormitories without genuinely just kind of like becoming more dour, especially if you're coming back from like a late night at the library or whatever. So there is like a real role for architecture here, not just in kind of like reviving like traditional Roger Scruton-esque notions of conservatism, which I agree there is, but also just it's like a very simplistic point, obviously, but just like to like make people happy. I mean, like we enjoy looking at things that are pretty, that shouldn't be that hard. And certainly, you know, if we're trying to kind of be like a, you know, like a Reaganite kind of shining city on the hill, a beacon unto the world, you know, the Trump program should make sense insofar as we want our capital city, if we want it to be kind of a shining city, to actually look decently appealing. You know, good for Hungary. They seem to be doing a lot of things right here. Shout out to our Hungarian friends.
Well, on a personal note as well, I continue to find it kind of funny and sad that my ancestors fled these Eastern European countries to come here. And now those Eastern European countries seem to be the defenders of Western civilization and its most basic traditions, national sovereignty, Judeo-Christian civilization as well. And America seems to want to repudiate them, at least now under the Biden administration and in prior administrations as well. I think that architecture, not that I'm any expert in aesthetics, but it does signal quite obviously whether you are devoted to tradition and classical conceptions of beauty, and that has a signaling effect that impacts people, even just subliminally. And to the extent you embrace something like a brutalist architecture, obviously that says something about, first of all, the direction of where your elite influencers in society are, and then also what the image they're trying to project to the public as well. So architecture does say something much deeper about civilization and also impacts civilization as well. I would just say it's a sad day for America when we purge these folks who are classical architecture focused and instead opt for something that is objectively ugly and ultimately puts us in a more dour mood and again signals a rejection of traditional aesthetics and a rejection of traditional principles, standards, and norms at its core. Oh, and with that, I guess I'll transition back to myself.
Yeah.
So on a completely different topic, the Wuhan lab leak theory, so-called, I don't necessarily have a soapbox to get up on this point, except to say that it should have been quite obvious many, many months ago that given, if nothing else, the Chinese Communist Party's actions to obfuscate, silence whistleblowers, bury evidence, et cetera, that they did not want us to understand the origins of the coronavirus, and that it was clear, again, just basic facts, that this laboratory in Wuhan near the supposed wet markets where they claim that this really emanated, the Chinese Communist Party being claimed it emanated, that there was a lab there where it appears gain of function research was being done on these various coronaviruses, and as well that the military operated there as well. I think part of the original attack on those who claim that the lab leak theory was at least one that ought to be seriously considered is that there was a conflation of, well, there are military officials operating there. So thus, this was essentially a bioweapon that the Chinese Communist Party unleashed in the world. And by the way, we should not reject that point out of hand. It would be absolutely foolish to reject any such theory out of hand, because there are all sorts of pieces of evidence, including their own rhetoric and literature, that would lead you to believe that they've considered all manner of bioweapons. So it is worth at least considering, and no one should be attacked for it. But of course, Tom Cotton and many others were attacked for it. And the Trump administration itself, over time, as they continued to collect evidence, continued to point out that there was circumstantial evidence indicating, including, for example, now we're finding out scientists who were sick several months before China claimed that patient zero emerged with the coronavirus, that there was circumstantial evidence out there. And I think the State Department itself, it was very telling that it put out a fact sheet towards the end of the Trump administration, pointing out the sort of data points that you could look to say that, look, this may very well be a viable theory. Now you have sort of more mainstream folks, including Nicholas Wade, I believe formerly of the New York Times, who put out a very lengthy examination of the lab leak theory versus that this emerged in a wet market or through a frozen foods or the like, basically saying, yeah, this is absolutely feasible. And it might even be not just probable, but likely. Now, why is it, I guess a question that I would pose to the group is, why is it now that you see publications like the New York Times and mainstream sort of scientific journalists who are only now in the Biden administration several months in coming out and saying, look, there's evidence that's emerged, much of which has already been out there for months in the public eye. Why only now is it acceptable to say that this is actually feasible, viable? Is it purely an issue of the Trump administration said it's a viable theory and thus we have to reject it out of hand? Or is there something else at play? And it was the reason that many in government, public officials, completely dismissed it out of hand, that it may implicate America to some extent because there were U.S. public health dollars that were going towards this facility. And thus, there might be U.S. public health officials, and again, dollars and those overseeing these programs, who are in some way indirectly culpable for what transpired at that laboratory. I open this up to just point out the question, why is it only now that the lab leak theory is gaining in prominence and there seems to be momentum? Why is it now only after the Trump administration is gone? And how can we explain it? What would the Biden administration's angle be if it was okay adopting the argument that the theory is viable? And while Jen Psaki, for example, I believe is throwing cold water on this to some extent, the head of the director of national intelligence has said that it is one of the two most likely theories in an open hearing as well. So this gets to origin of coronavirus itself. China's culpability in it, which the Biden administration clearly has no desire to actually pursue. But why is it that this theory is now getting prominence? And what do you think the angle is of the Biden administration not tamping down on the voices that are getting behind this theory? I'd open that up to the group.
This is a damning statement on our elite class and on their megaphone, the corporate media. It's unbelievable the way they treated people who took seriously the theory that this may have emerged from the lab, which has always been a clearly reasonable theory. And when you look at, you know, let us consider the arc of Fauci himself, who is possibly signed off on some of the decisions to do the gain of function work at that particular laboratory, or to at least have grants sent in that direction. You know, you now have him saying, well, you know, I'm not ready to rule that out. That's incredible. That's an incredible flip-flop, but nobody ever gets called out for it. Nobody ever gets called out for the way they treated conservatives who said one thing. And it's a great example of something we talk a lot about on this podcast, which is our decadence and our obsession with political correctness is actually hampering our efficiency as a country, because we spent a year putting our head in the sands and the media assisted people that may have been culpable in government and people who were saying false things outright in government, putting their head in the sands for a year during this pandemic, acting like a reasonable theory for its origins could not possibly have been true. And if you say so, you are a crazy conspiracy theorist. Everybody listening to this and every normal person in the country should realize that when the media is saying things are conspiracies, that doesn't actually make them conspiracies. And that's really unfortunate, because it gives the sort of murky definition of what constitutes conspiratorial thinking and what constitutes unreasonable ideas, so that all of these perfectly reasonable ideas are lumped in with 9/11 trutherism and with crazy nonsense conspiracy theories. This is a smear, and nobody will have to reckon with it in the legacy media. That's disgusting. And it's exactly the type of thing that should, you know, help the country wake up to the fact that you cannot trust our elite class as far as you can throw them. You know, they are corrupt to their core. And they have this assistance in the form of our media. This is just one of those perfect illustrations of that. And it's a real bummer, because it's making, you know, it's tearing at our social fabric, and it's making us less efficient as a country. It's a complete disgrace, and nobody will have to answer for it.
Wow. Well, that was fire from Emily. I agree with everything she just said. I'll just quickly kind of underscore the point. I mean, I think at least three things are going on here. Ben kind of flagged two of them. One is, this is just a very, very, very bad case of orange man bad. As soon as Trump comes out flying, starts calling it the China virus, the left's politically correct machine comes into play, you know, ignore that whole like discriminate against Asians and like Harvard and Yale admissions thing. As soon as that happens, they say, if Trump's saying this, it's obviously wrong. It's true, the U.S. taxpayer was involved, at least to some extent, in subsidizing the laboratory in question in Wuhan, China. But the bigger question, the bigger issue here, from my perspective, and this is kind of what Emily is getting at, is that our vested interests, the post kind of Nixon goes to China ruling class, the bipartisan ruling class, and, you know, and no one underscored this like Lee Smith, who's written about this at great length for Tablet. He had a fabulous essay a few months ago called The 30 Tyrants, talking about just the depraved extent, frankly, to which our ruling class elites in this country are in bed with the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, we talk about this all the time. You know, we talked about Disney and Xinjiang, obviously Nike, Apple. Just few companies are worse than Apple as far as complicity in what is happening in China. There are so many vested interests here, political, economic, investment. It's all across the board. So I think what is happening here, when what you saw, in addition to the other two factors, you know, orange man bad and the U.S. taxpayer issue, is you saw just the ruling class kind of rise up and exert serious pressure to try to salvage what could possibly remain of the post Nixon goes to China US-China relationship, because it's frankly good for their bottom line. So I think that's what's happened here too. And it's remarkable that it took this long for the narrative to collapse and for the truth to start to come out, but I'm obviously happy that it is.
Yeah, real briefly, I think something Emily said at the very end, I think is so true, which is that nobody will pay a price for this. And if you look at how badly, you know, people failed at the core function of their profession. And what I mean by this is the core function of journalism is intellectual curiosity.
the core function of journalism is not taking things at face value. And so many of our major journalism outlets that purport to be, you know, to be completing that function are so captured by politics and so captured by ideological groupthink that they are now incapable of doing this. All you have to do is go back and do a quick Google search. It was CNN calling Tom Cotton a conspiracy theorist, USA Today saying he was dangerous, you know, for saying that this might be true. PolitiFact at the Washington Post rated the whole claim pants on fire and then had to quietly retract that claim this week. And so it just goes to the rot, I think, in our institutions, but also a very rotten thing about DC, which is that here in this city, in the elite lands of it, if you fail miserably at the core function of your profession, you will get a promotion. That's the consequence of this. And so I do think that, to Emily's point, there's no more damning example of the corporately funded groupthink that is subjecting the rest of the country to outright, you know, kind of falsehoods in this situation. So it's really unredeemable in my mind. But with that, I think we can bring it to our final closing thoughts around the room. I'll kind of throw it open to whoever wants to start with that.
Let me just follow up on, put a bow on that last conversation, which is that I buried the lead to some extent, which is that, of course, the indirect, maybe direct beneficiary of the attacks on those who put forth this theory, credibly so and reasonably so, was, of course, the Chinese Communist Party. So there is the narrow political orange man bad, let's use this against Trump and let's get him out of office. But there's also the covering for the Chinese Communist Party effectively involved. And also, by the way, the Chinese Communist Party controlled World Health Organization, which had at least one American individual, a senior individual, who was very involved in the activities going on at Wuhan and led the letter in The Lancet, which claimed essentially that the lab leak theory was a fallacious theory. So worth pointing that out. And I think more broadly, the broader geopolitical ramifications, one is, we also adopted, in effect, the narrative that the Chinese Communist Party wanted to adopt, which is that this is a crazy conspiracy theory, number one. Number two, that we should lock down our country in perpetuity is something that the Chinese Communist Party itself advocated, the WHO amplified, and which had never been done in the history of the world. And of course, this is accrued to China's benefit, at least on a relative basis, vis-a-vis the rest of the mostly free but increasingly erodingly free world. So it is worth putting this in its proper geopolitical context. And it has to be said, China had to be held accountable for its culpability in this, has to be held accountable for it, or it will show that it can act with total impunity. And I think the fact that the Biden administration went right back into the WHO, no strings attached, first thing, and put back on the table the hundreds of millions of dollars of funding that it gets, taxpayer dollars of ours, sent a very clear signal that we were going to completely kowtow to the CCP and that it would get off scot-free in spite of the horrible efforts that it took in connection with spreading this virus in effect around the world. And that is a very damning fact that we're going to be grappling with for generations, potentially.
The idea that the lab leak theory was a conspiracy is as ridiculous as the idea that brutalist buildings are objectively beautiful. Everything that is coming from our elite class is wrong. It is rooted in an entirely rotten and incoherent philosophy. And that is exactly why we are where we are, because women are getting so many mixed cultural signals. Men are getting mixed cultural signals about something. It's just things as basic as masculinity and femininity. We are untethered, or we are attempting to be untethered by our cultural establishment from what is actually just human nature and from what is actually reality, from truth and objectivity. And that's why we're floundering with things as basic as the facts when it comes to that Wuhan laboratory, and as basic as what beauty is and what a beautiful building would look like and what men are and what women are. It's all rooted in this completely rotten and incoherent modern philosophy. And, you know, that it's going to take so much work to sort of wrest back the culture from that. But the good news is that, you know, it is, at the end of the day, human nature does exist, and people sort of are able to intuitively recognize what's true and what's false and what's beautiful and what's not. And so there's some hope to be found in that.
Yeah, I mean, that really is kind of the recurring theme of this particular episode, right? It's just this total disconnect between the ruling class and the median American, which is obviously kind of a recurring theme, perhaps par excellence of this podcast so far. With the first segment, I mean, the median American sees, a free ally trying to defend itself against indiscriminate rocket fire from an internationally recognized genocidal Islamist death cult. And they obviously don't agree with the rhetoric that is coming out of Rashida Tlaib, AOC, or the New York Times editorial board, going on to the fertility crisis. The median American understands, I think, less so perhaps than 50 years ago, but still, I think, in his or her heart to this day, that the greatest fulfillment in life does not necessarily come from maximizing financial returns, from monetization of your vocation, of your career, and so forth. And then obviously, on the Wuhan lab thing, I mean, the notion that the lab leak was a quote unquote conspiracy theory, you know what it reminds me of, actually? I mentioned him already earlier, my friend Gladden Papin. A lot of conservatives like to mock this notion that the so-called slippery slope is a fallacy. I remember learning that my first year of law school. The slippery slope phenomenon is not a quote unquote fallacy. Okay. What I've seen Gladden put on Twitter, he refers to it as like the iron law of the slippery slope, like trademark. So the same way that like the slippery slope like actually is an iron law here. It's the same conceit, I guess the point I'm making here, the same conceit that says like, oh, stop it. Stop with your slippery slope fear-mongering. It's the same thing that's getting out the Wuhan lab as a conspiracy. This was obviously a plausible thing in the beginning. But the broader point here is that, to underscore what Emily is saying, I think the ruling class in our country, with each week, with each story, with each new kind of instance of big tech censorship, with each new instance of, of what Ben has been written prolifically about the domestic war on terror, with all the shenanigans pertaining to the fallout from January 6th, with Fauci flip-flopping on the lab, the ruling class loses its credibility every single day when something like this happens. And we really do seem to be reaching kind of a breaking point of sorts. And that, above all, is kind of the that is the way in for a revitalized conservative movement, is kind of getting to that chasm, that split between the ruling class and the sentiments of the median American. And that is why I'm at the end of the day still hopeful, because they are so out of touch that if we just kind of rediscover the tools in our arsenal and put them to use, we will appeal and recover the sentiment of the median American and actually put it to good and viable political use.
But I think for the right to do that, I think it has to begin to resolve the constant tension that exists in conservatism between the markets and the culture, the markets and the family. And I think that tension, I find that tension is where a lot of conservative creativity springs. But I think for the last 40 years, conservatives have just been captured by this notion that, market forces will save us. If we infuse market forces into these things, somehow we'll save whatever institution it is. And I think in many cases it's failed, because it's forced conservatives to prioritize economic policy over and above the culture. And in ceding so many cultural battles, we've left ourselves with no power in any of these institutions. And so I really do think it's, Yuval Levin wrote about this over 10 years ago, this constant tension that exists on this front. And so I do think it's incumbent upon conservatives to start to reconcile that, because if I think Josh is right, and I think to get to that point, we have to reconcile this, within ourselves, to be able to say, no, they both matter. And the economic transacts upon the cultural and vice versa, and be able to, recognize the state does have a role in some cases to create a space in which our values can flourish and a diversity of values can flourish. And recognize that occasionally means we have to pick up the sword and beat the government back into that box, where the left tries to make it the sole beginning and end of everything that we do. So that's sort of a meta narrative that I've been thinking about with the right. So I think we can leave it there for today. On behalf of Ben, Emily, and Josh, thank you for tuning in. I'm Rachel Bovard, and we'll see you on the next NetCon Squad.